Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun.
It's time for another episode of Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson. Join Tom as he talks to the artists, writers, performers, and personalities that affect that... Well, that he could talk into being on the show. Here's Tom.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson podcast. I am such an egomaniac, I put my name in the title of it. But I figured, you know, you have to know who's here, right? I'm him. I'm Tom Wilson, oddly enough. I'm your bubbly and ebullient host. Yes, leading you on another magical sleigh ride of entertainment and wonder as we glide across verdant hills of green, watching our best selves rise above the small foibles of the day and reminding us that we... I don't know. There was in each of us is a bubbling reservoir of hope within us. And all we have to do is knock that the hope valve thing with a mallet and let it flow out of our best selves. Wow. I was reaching on that one. Hey, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for downloading it. Thanks for being here. I'm back off the road. That Dulles to LA. Okay, I'm not going to go there. You know what? Air travel is inconvenient. But I'm a big person. So the long ones, the six-hour ones, wow, that's something when you know that the person next to you hates you. Because I take up a lot of room on a plane, not just for legs. I mean, I'm one of those guys. I don't take a third of your seat, but I have to really kind of put my arms forward for you to have a part of the armrest. So the person next to me, I try to get on there first before the person next to me comes in so that I can be welcoming and say, "Hi, welcome to row 8. I'm Tom. I'll be next to you, and I'll be taking over up to 20% of your seat, but we're going to have fun." And they just sit down silently and try to avoid making eye contact. When they're already there and I'm coming in, then I just say, "Congratulations, it's your lucky day." You know, because if something bad happens and we need to get to the exit, I can get there very quickly, and I'll throw you ahead of me, so you'll actually get out way quicker. But I'm back off. Do you know when you're a big guy like that? Because I was at this gig, and big people know this. Smaller people might not. But when you're a large guy like me, people really feel like they can manhandle you. They really feel wrestle around. I get like people grab my neck a lot. You know, and they kind of that thing. And I'm not that much of a guy. So it's always, I'm still not used to it. But at this last week of shows, I got hit by a drunk lady twice. She hit me after the show, and she was she'd had a lot to drink. Imagine that at a nightclub in America late on a Friday night. But she'd had a lot to drink, and she was sort of in the front of the showroom during the show, and interestingly, she never heckled me. She heckled me a little bit. She said a few things, but I didn't even come back on her that much. I didn't really put her down early on, but she decided that her heckling way would be to give me the finger throughout the show. I have no idea why. I think the show was going well. I was being friendly to people, and this one woman was the double finger. Both hands just giving me the finger the whole entire show. So I didn't get it, but whatever. The show is over, and I'm meeting people and greeting them as I like to do after shows, and everyone's friendly, and she comes up, and I'm thinking, she might want to take a picture or something, and let's just get this over with. And she came up and just smacked me, like on the side of my arm, like, "You don't know what you're talking about." Really hit me. So I do the whole, hey, ma'am, let's not hit each other, because that's not right, right? To hit each other, that's a no-no. You might get a timeout for that. Some joke like that. She hits me again even harder. So then I call the security guy. Hey, Matt, could you please? And he comes over. He's also a big guy. But, you know, as a big guy, we're not even allowed to move people, kind of. You can't really touch them that much, because we know when the security guy, when the cop comes there, they come to the big guy going, all right, what happened, gorilla man? So you can't really do it. So Matt's standing there, just sort of standing in the way as she's totally verbally trying to rip me to shreds in her drunken stupor and trying to hit me again. And he's kind of standing there, because I said, could we get rid of her? Let's get her out of here. And say, well, if I move her, if I put my hands on her and move her and throw her, then, you know, she's going to trip and, you know, get a concussion, and then I'm in prison. So that's the plight of the big guy. I'll have to try to find very small violin music while I play that. But it's just an observation of mine that when you're big, people think they can hit you. And they get away with it. They really – I'm not making this up. On the way back from this trip, I got hit by two different people. There was a smaller man of some kind of a culture that, you know, the United States was not his native country. Let's just say that. I won't, I can't generalize. I can't make up something. It was made possibly the Middle East, possibly Pakistan, possibly Afghanistan. I don't know. But a country like that. And he was a smaller guy who was just, you know, when the plane, it's over, the flight's over, everyone gets up and they're putting their bags together and everything. And then there's a guy who's really pressing up against you because he really wants to get out of there. So he's pressing up against me. Okay, whatever, I'm doing my bag thing. He just starts pushing me aside in order to get for, not saying excuse me, not just pushing me. I turn to him, sir, first of all, usually people say excuse me. And secondly, like, there's a person in front of me. I can't move. I'm getting out. I'm trying to get a, whatever. I'd say, I can't move, sir. I can't move. So he keeps pushing against me. And so I continue to do my bag, trying to stay cool. Don't want to get into a situation on a plane. So he starts pushing me harder just for me to get aside. I turn to him, doing the sort of big guy thing, not pushing him or anything, but just standing there and saying, sir, there's nowhere for you to go. I mean, I'm in front of you. There's a lady in front of me. There's a guy in front of her. You're going to get out of here when everyone gets to get out of here. He punched me in the neck. I'm not making it up. The guy punched me in the neck, going, I'm getting out of it. But he punched me in the neck, and he just starts, you know, fighting me. And I mean, I'm not fighting the dude, because I'm on a plane. I'm just now I'm calling out like, witnesses, please, people, watch this. And people behind me are going, like, we get it, okay, we're watching this. But then I know, well, first, I know that, you know, if I wrestle the guy to the ground, whatever, you know, everyone's video cameras are out, and it's Back to the Future dude beats up, a poor starving Pakistani refugee or whatever. So I can't do that. But the guy, I have to let the guy buy me. He wins. The guy who just punches you in the neck and doesn't say anything and just keeps pushing, you know, he won that day. So So I drove home from LAX not in the best mood. I was not in the best mood, but I'm in the good mood now. You know, that's a part of the reason why I started doing stand-up. not because a guy punched me in the neck, although, you know, that happened also. But just being big, I was a late bloomer big guy. So I became a big guy with the kind of the soul of the smaller asthmatic debate team tuba player kid. So, but when I wanted to be an actor, when I started a life in the arts, I was always the biggest guy in the class. I was always the biggest guy at any audition. I was auditioning for Stanley Kowalski. And well, first of all, I was a young kid, but secondly, you know, the casting people said, well, we can't have Stanley Kowalski look like he can, you know, actually play for the Rams or something. So, So I started doing stand-up in order to do my own show. It's ultimately democratic. They have a microphone there, and they have a stage, and it's just you alone. So I just started to write stuff and get up on stage and just do my show. And I liked it. It was fun. It was unbelievable to me. I started getting good at it. I started getting gigs, making money. Now, the stereotype of a stand-up comedian is really made by lazy writers who don't know anything. Because, of course, the stereotype of the stand-up comedian is the angst-ridden, drug-addled, tragic figure, you know, destined to die, destitute and anguished after a life of trying to pull love and acceptance out of diminishing laughter and dwindling ticket sales late at night over, you know, whatever, you know, over the heroin needle and beer and cigarettes. Well, that's okay. I've been a comic for a long time now. And I'll admit, that's some of them. That is some of them. And I've known them. But a lot of them, certainly my friends and a lot of guys I know, are like me. Guys and girls who are saying now, hey, I figured out a way to beat the system. I don't have a boss. I win. Everyone else had to wear a tie and fit in. I get paid specifically for not fitting in. Score. I figured out a way to do it. I used the fire escape. I got out of the building. And now I'm out here, you know, doing my shows and living my life and painting my pictures and acting in my things and no one really can boss me around, or I could just go, I quit. So Dennis Regan is a comedian that I know. And I think he's one of those guys. Dennis is always has always been friendly to me. We're not very, very close friends, because I think you only become really close friends with comedians who you started out with, because those are the guys and girls that you've spent 5 hours standing in the back of a nightclub just talking about everything, or outside on the curb waiting for your spot. Once you really start doing spots, you're kind of going from club to club and you're making very, very nice acquaintances. But that's me and Dennis. We've known each other for a long time, and we've had a few very nice meals together, or when we're on the road together. I remember one, we had a great meal in Texas together. We were both playing a club, and it was great. But Dennis always impressed me as a sensible guy, you know, a nuts and bolts stand-up, a guy who approached it in a very intelligent way, going, hey, this looks like an interesting way to have a creative release and to make a living. If it works out, and it's worked out great for him. He's been on The Tonight Show and Letterman. He's done every stand-up comic credential that you can have. He certainly has. He's been on the writing staff of The King of Queens, so he knows about television writing. And I just thought it would be a lot of fun to speak with a very talented and sensible stand-up comedian. Here's my conversation with Dennis Regan.
It's Big Pop Fun.
Well, it was sort of a test when the thing goes on and stuff.
Should I say?
I don't. That wasn't my like. Hello. Should I do it again? I don't know what to do at the beginning of them. You know, where you say Dennis Regan's my guest here on the podcast.
So we're on.
We're on now.
Oh, okay.
Unless you don't want to be.
No, I would do a test.
Okay, go ahead.
I would do a test. Thanks for having me.
Oh, sure.
That was my test.
It's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. I don't know much about you, Dennis. We've seen each other. We certainly know each other as comics. We were at that gig in Texas once. We had a very nice meal together.
Yeah.
But I don't know, like, where are you from? Are you from back east?
I grew up in Miami, Florida.
In Miami?
Yeah. I know. Yeah, that's people don't think.
It's a very major city, and yet I guess people are just struck. Miami seems exotic or something.
People think of Miami, they think of people lying out by the pool and walking, you know, on the coconut trees and stuff like that. They don't think of a 7-year-old boy walking to school with his book bag in Miami, but that's what it was. It was.
Was it a pretty normal child?
It was,
mom work, or your mom was just at home?
No, mom was at home. My dad worked for Eastern Airlines, and so we got to take trips and fly. We always went to Binghamton, New York, which was where my mom and dad were from.
If you're going to take a trip from Miami, why not Binghamton?
When we got a little bit older, you know, they wanted to be around family. And then when we got a little bit older, we started singing this song. We got tired of Binghamton, even though we like seeing the family. We got tired. Like, we realized that, you know, we could be going to different places. And we're spending weeks and 2 weeks in Binghamton. Remember that song, We Gotta Get Out of This Place? Remember that? We gotta get out
of this. Oh, sure, yeah.
Well, there was one trip where we just kept singing that. We gotta get out of this place. Parents, it's a better vacation for me and you. So, yeah, Miami, Florida.
Did you vacation anywhere else, or did you?
That was the. Well, we did do. We did do some other trips, but mostly that was it. We go up there to see the family because my dad was pretty cool. My dad and mom. I mean, everybody else stayed up in Binghamton, and my dad went to Miami in during World War II when he was in the Army. Got off the bus down there in December, and he was just wearing short sleeve shirt and 80 degrees. And he says, "You got to be kidding me!"
Yeah.
So after the war, he and my mom got married, and went down there for the honeymoon, and then decided to just stay.
And Dad just got a job with the airline.
Not at first. He had another job. He had a couple other jobs, but then he got a job with Eastern Airlines.
Uh huh. Yeah. Well, he was just in the Army, World War II.
Yeah, he was in the Army about a month before the war ended. He was fairly young.
Oh, that's kind of lucky.
Yeah, well, I think maybe the war ended because he had enlisted.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
They finally gave up because
they
he was that tough?
Walt Reagan's just enlisted and throw up their
hands. So it sounded,
it's white flag.
It had nothing to do with the Hiroshima thing or the...
It might have had something
the German
to do with it.
Retreat.
Do with
no,
that, yeah.
it was the Reagan guy showing up. So you grew up in Miami with brothers and sisters?
Yeah.
Now, early on, we'll say you are a professional comedian, and you are also the brother of another Brian Regan, who a professional comedian. Are there any others? Is this
any
a Wayans thing?
Any other
comedians? Is this Damon, Marlon, you know, Keenan Ivory?
Brian and I. There's eight brothers and sisters in my family. Some people use the word sibling. I think that's a weird word. I don't know. Siblings.
Yeah.
Do you have any siblings? But I do have seven siblings. But there's eight brothers and sisters. And at one point, we had two comedians, two firemen, two school teachers, and two car salesmen. It lined up that way at one time.
Is that total chance, or was one sort of drafting off the other?
No, it wasn't.
So some guy becomes a fireman, and the other goes, "Hey, man, not bad."
Maybe a little bit of that. I mean, there was drafting with the comedy.
What happened there?
Well, Brian was doing comedy for 6 or 7 years before I started, but I didn't decide to go into comedy so much. I was like 33 years old when I started, but I saw Brian was having fun, and it was just something I thought that I might be able to do. And I got to a point in my life where I started to test myself and do things that I was kind of afraid of doing and challenge myself. And that was one of the things I challenged myself to do, was go to a open mic night.
Yeah. What were you – I mean, before that, did you kind of went to school and studied something and were working, or?
I went to a lot of schools and studied a lot of things.
Like a lot of comedians did.
I guess. But I moved from job to job.
Yeah.
I had jobs I liked and jobs I didn't like.
Yeah.
But I just kind of kicked around.
So the open mic night, how'd that go?
It went well enough. I think it was December 20th was the date. And I followed Santa Claus. And he killed, of course. You know, they love him. He's been bringing him toys all the time.
Oh, they're sure.
So they were on his side. I didn't think he was that good. But no, it was he just kind of showed up and kind of a special guest Santa Claus. But I went up and I had fun. I did this thing that was just kind of a one-time only bit where I was afraid I was going to forget my skitches. So I had him on a card, and then I did this thing where I said I pretended like I forgot what I was going to say, and then I pulled the cards out of the index cards out of my pocket, and I said I read them, and I just said hello, And then I turned the first card over and it said hello in big block letters. And I got a big laugh from my first thing. But that wasn't something I could, you know, keep in the act for very long. But then I had some other legitimate bits that worked pretty well. And you know, it was fun enough to want to go back, and I went back. And
did you go back fast? You went back the next early week. On. You figured, hey, not bad. Let's keep going.
Yeah. You know, what, the next week or so, whenever you could get back on, you had to call in, and you had to speed dial to see if you could get on the waiting list for the Sunday night open mic nights. But then there was a few open mic nights. So I was actually pretty quick. I got a lot of stage time in front of legitimate audiences. I say that because now a lot of comedians struggle. I feel for them because they're getting up in front of other comedians and
just kind of six guys in the back of the room with 8 or 12 empty tables in front of them.
And I sort of kid because I've gotten up in those situations a couple times myself, and I say asking other comedians for a laugh is like asking a homeless guy for a quarter. You know, I mean, they got their own ideas if what they're going to do. They're mm-hmm. nervous about going up to perform. But I was lucky. It was during the heyday of comedy. It was like 1987, right? And three clubs opened up in Dade County where I lived, and then three clubs in Broward County, and I think there was two or three up in West Palm Beach County. So I paid my dues as far as driving. And even after a full day's work at some other job, I would, you know, drive for an hour and 15 minutes to do 5 minutes. But I was getting up in front of audiences, and I got my first pay gig, I think, like 4 months in. I got some guy who, Gene Marola owned a little comedy club in Fort Lauderdale. I don't know why it was called Casey's, because Gene owned it, but it was Casey's Comedy Club. And he said he gave me $30 to do 10 minutes. And how I had 10 minutes, I don't know. But I did. And 30 minutes to do a set on Friday and two sets on Saturday, which I did. And I couldn't believe I got $90 at the end. And I was doing what was so much fun.
Yeah.
So, like, within 4 months, I got paid $90.
Well, that's good. But now going back to your family, I mean, you know, where we get,
and that's the most I've gotten paid.
Was the peak
up to this?
Well, you peaked very early, which is it happens to some people. It happens to some people. Who was funny in your family? I mean, besides everybody. I mean, the big family like that. There are a lot of people, but where did that seed do you think really come from?
Well, I think my dad's family. I think that was a big thing in my dad's family. Like since we were down in Miami, we were sort of excluded from the family for the most part, except for vacations. But I think my grandmother and my was very funny on my dad's side. My dad was very funny. My mom was not. She was funny, but she was more of like a tough crowd, is what I'd say. You'd say something if you made my mom laugh, then you had something. You did something. You did something right.
So you're 4 months in and making $90 over two nights, a fortune. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of clubs, so
you got to remember this is 1887.
Yeah, I know. Custer had just lost the battle of Little Bighorn, and we were just the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah.
So, but at what point do you think? I think I'm going to take a shot at this.
You know what? I have a good answer to that. I think because it was just fun. When I did well in front of a small crowd, I remember it was at the Comic Strip in Fort Lauderdale, and I showed up there, and there was like 16 people in the audience, and none of the other comics had done well that night, and I don't remember I hadn't done well in front of a small crowd up till then, and they were seated strangely. You see people over here, three people over there. It was no cohesion to the audience, and I went up and I did. I got laughs, and I was the only one that night. But more importantly, I was able to get. People think it's hard to go up in front of a big crowd. That's more nerve wracking. That's easier, you know, because you know some people are going to get what you're doing, and then the other people will kind of listen. Oh, it must be funny, and they kind of and it's contagious. Laughter is contagious. But when you have 16 people that are seated over here and over there, and it's kind of weird. It's a weird number because they don't know that they're a small crowd. They just think that it's uncomfortable, you know. But that night that I did well in front of a small crowd, I started thinking, well, that's kind of the real world out there, because you got Wednesday nights and you got Tuesday nights and Sunday nights when it's the Super Bowl and the club still wants to have a show. And then I started to think I could do it.
And so at that point, your brother, I mean, it was the comedy boom, so I'm sure Brian had a lot of gigs, but he hadn't really been doing concerts or that kind of stuff. He was just going to clubs.
No, he was like actually, everyone. He was struggling. He was, I say struggling, not struggling. He was grinding, you know. He was working, yeah. He was middling some, getting some headlining gigs, but he was moving along.
Yeah. Did you, when you started to approach it like, this is something I'm going for, did your writing change in order to do something, you know, different from him or from the guys in Miami or anything? Or was it just like, well, like most of us, certainly like me, is, well, look, whatever I come up with that's funny, I'm going to just keep that and chuck the stuff that yeah, doesn't do well.
There was no shift. I was a little different when I began. I remember being I was more of adult. I was
as a sort of a character, not a
little bit more of a
not an acting piece, but your jokes coming from a character.
A little
kind of
bit
thing.
More of a like a Tommy Smothers type thing. Like yeah. Everything out of me was kind of stupidish, yeah. You know. But and that was just gradual to kick out of that, where it was more me on stage. I do remember Brian wasn't around. Brian was up in New York, and I would talk to him on the phone. He was very curious because he knew I was funny. But yeah. Over the years, I'd give him a bit or two, and I'd say, hey, try this, you know. But and he'd come back, and he'd say it worked or it didn't work. But I had an idea, more than most comedians that get started. I had an idea about how to write a joke. I had an idea that there had to be a laugh point. I didn't call it that, a punchline. You know, it had to be a place where this is where you stop talking and they're supposed to start laughing rather than just going up there with funny premises and all that stuff. But still, everybody's, you know, it's there's a lot to learn. There's a lot to learn. It's not just about being a funny person. So you get up and you learn a little bit the first night, you learn a little bit the second night. But he was curious about what I was doing. It was before video was as easy. You know, you didn't videotape.
You couldn't
yourself.
Just like look at this stuff on YouTube,
yeah,
or here's the thing.
Even
look at my
audio
set.
Record it and send it. You might audio record it, but you didn't know how to. You couldn't
yeah,
send it.
Mail it to cassette.
So
or
I was telling him over the phone what I was doing and stuff like that. And he was very gracious and supportive. You know, and you know, I'm sure there was lots of things which I would tell him, which he had probably heard a million times. You know, when we are all new, we think this is the very most clever thing. And then you see, after you're out there for 6 months, you go, well, okay, so everybody else is clever too, right?
Right. Because,
but I remember
especially when you get to New York or L.A. and you find out, wow, there's
no, what I mean by that is
dust.
You're hearing everybody doing the same bit. You're going, oh, well, it's not that clever. Yeah. It was an easy kind of premise. I need something a little bit off the track.
Yeah.
But I remember one time I had good success. I didn't bomb. You know, audiences were very forgiving, especially on open mic nights. And so I didn't bomb for a handful of times, or even like 20 or 30 times or whatever it was. And I told Brian one time on the phone, I said, you know, I think I might have one of those acts that's like bomb proof. And he was like, oh, okay. All right. Like, okay, you know, here, you know. So, and then the next week I had the pleasure of calling him and saying,
yeah,
I it's not bomb-proof.
Yeah. Remember that I've thing learned, about the bomb-proof thing I said?
Back. Yeah, I take that back.
I just find it interesting. My brother, I mean, I did almost the same kind of thing as the guy who was in comedy, and then the boom is going on, and not so much as a money-making thing.
What do you mean?
But,
that
my younger brother, Jeff, started to do comedy.
Oh.
That he was, I think, nervous to go on stage alone, so he got in with a friend of his.
This was after you or before you?
This was after me.
Okay.
You know, I was the guy. I had moved to L.A., and then he moved out there. And tried it with this friend of his, George. They actually performed at the Comedy Store, and they didn't do badly, but I think it just didn't have – it didn't just get any gravitational pull.
And you mean just he went up once?
He went once at the Comedy Store. They were doing all the clubs in L.A., the Deli Smoker and all the kind of – and the open mics and that kind of stuff. But and then they came on open mic night to the Comedy Store. They actually did well, and I think that's the last time they performed.
Well, it's, you want to go out on a win, I guess.
You just go, well, that was good, I think. But it's it was an interesting experiment for him. But ultimately, he's when I just don't think it's my thing.
Well, one thing I tell – you know, there's lots of people who are interested in trying it, and I always encourage them. But one thing I tell them is that how you do your first night has no – indication is no bearing whatsoever on how well you could do at this business. There's no other craft or business in the world that people expect to be good at from the beginning. But for some reason, people go up on their first open mic and they think it's either a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And if they don't do well, they walk away devastated and go, that wasn't for me. Where I think a lot of us just got lucky. The Man in the Moon,
The
comedian.
The Andy Kaufman Andy movie Kaufman, with Jim Carrey?
No, I just went off on
Andy
on
Kaufman
clips
pieces.
Of the wrestling and all that stuff like that, like what was going on with the wrestling. But yeah, the Smothers Brothers, my dad was a refrigerator salesman.
Yeah, refrigerator salesman, Colorways refrigerator. but you went off on Andy Kaufman for an evening?
Yes. I just can't help but smiling about all that stuff that he did with the wrestling and the intergender wrestling and wrestling the women and the things he was saying. Like, I can beat any woman. There's never been, I mean, it's not like it hasn't been discussed, but there was never been anything like him. And I, you know, where the joke ended and where it started and stuff like that, I don't know. It's still a mystery to me sometimes. Like, some people seem to think that they got it and they get it, but I think part of the beauty with him was you think you got it, he's got something else.
Yeah, I think so, because I think the joke's on them too.
Yeah,
because it was I only met the guy. I mean, I didn't even really meet him, but I was around him when he was performing at the Comedy Store many, many years ago when I was just a doorman there. Mm-hmm. And yeah, he was doing whatever brand of unusual confrontational theater that he was doing on stage. I found him doing that off stage as well.
Right.
I found it a theater piece from the time he walked up to the club till he got on stage until he left. Because I never, you know, you never got a straight answer out of him. Or he wouldn't speak to me, and then the next time he's wearing a absolutely ridiculous fake beard and mustache. So I'm a kid, and he's walking in, and I figure I haven't met the guy. I say, hey, Andy, how's it going? And he goes into he just absolutely reams me for noticing him in front of people, you know. I'm wearing a disguise. I'm wearing a mustache and a beard. If anyone knows that I'm here, they're going to make a scene about it. And I don't need – so, you know, I was a kid, you know, and I'm standing there going, I don't – like what is he really – is he crazy or is he putting on a show now with me as a character in the show for the three
he's got you on your heels,
or what? Well, he had me on my heels because I think I was young and I was very, very new out here. I mean, I know, like Freddie Prinze years back, some comic came up to me afterwards because I was like, is he going to get me fired now or something?
Right.
Am I in trouble because Andy Kaufman, you know, just is mad at me? And some comic came up to me and said, oh, no, don't worry about it, man. I mean, Freddie Prinze threatened to just punch his face in once because he came in as that Tony Clifton and did some, you know, some rude Tony Clifton-esque thing.
Right.
To Freddie Prinze, and Freddie Prinze says, you know, I know you're Andy, I know you're wearing makeup, and I will, you know, and I will knock you out if you talk to me again like that. And it was, oh, okay. So Tony Clifton did not speak to Freddie Prinze again.
So you were a doorman at the at the Comedy Store?
I was.
Back when Blake Clark was also?
Blake and I. Blake, I've done many, as the listeners know, I've done many episodes with Blake about our time there at the Comedy Store.
You know, I saw that he was on there, but I haven't listened to them yet.
Blake's mowing the lawn behind me right now.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I learned something from Blake when I first started. I was working at a club in the Comedy Corner in West Palm Beach. And, well, actually I learned a couple things. But this, so when I had worked there before, I was like just middling. You know, I was doing 20 minutes in front of the headliners that would come through. And some of the other headliners stayed at the hotels, but I was staying in this house that was near the club, but basically the comedy condo, but it was a house. And Blake stayed there too. And we went out and had lunch one day, and I asked him, I said, why do you stay in the house? Why do you stay in the condo? When you know, you could stay at a hotel if you wanted to. And he said, well, he said, I want to come back. I want to come back. I want this club to make as much money as they can. And I don't need to bust their chops. I'm fine with the, you know, it might not be, you know, the dream palace or anything. But I want to make as much money. And then he said this. He said, as long as it's, you know, clean and dry. And I was like, dry? You know, what do you mean dry? You know, so only somebody who had fought in Vietnam would even factor in that the place right. might not be dry. But the thing that I learned there was, you know, the relationships with people in places, you know, like you want the club to make as much money as they can. You make as much money as you can so that you have a continue. You don't want to come back to, I did this, I want this. If it's not necessary, you don't
right.
bust chops, you know.
No, I completely agree. And I think you'll be the first guy, the demanding guy, will be the first guy that they say, nah, it was kind of a hassle, and why bring him back?
Right.
So you might as well get along with people. But yes, Blake and I and Harris Pete and all those guys were the doormen of the Comedy Store, you know, pre-comedy boom. I mean,
did you ever physically throw out anybody together with Blake or by yourself? Or
yeah, we did. We did some of that. We did some of that. Blake, I would just stand there because I was just physically large. So Blake did a lot of the talking, you know, that kind of like, listen, you've had too much to drink, so get out. Let's go. Move your stuff. And I just sort of be standing behind him.
Like rule number one, be nice from Roadhouse.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're just they would always leave. I didn't get in one fist fight while I was there.
No.
Because I could act. I mean, my acting, it actually helped me
yeah.
as a bouncer.
Yeah.
Because I could do that, go up to three guys and say, whatever, you know, mm-hmm. you guys are out of here. And the last thing you want is all three of you to be in the hospital arrested.
Oh, you,
so
you,
let's
you
go.
Really pull, you would really pull
I
that.
Pull that once in a blue moon. But mm-hmm. I swear, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, dear God, please don't let them hit me. Please help this to work. I'm out of options.
Don't let them see the
yes,
fear.
Yes, exactly. They are not listening to anything I do, and they think, you know, I have to go to the absolute end in order to do it.
So the next time a bouncer comes up to me and threatens me that way, and it happens quite frequently.
I'm sure it does.
I'm going to grab him by the collar. And
yeah.
I'm gonna call his bluff.
Yeah, if he's anything like me, he'll immediately start to cry and just go, yeah! You know, he'll be making little animal noises and stuff.
I'll just slap him and say, now get out of here and go, you know, freshen my drink or something like that.
Yeah, and when did you move out here?
1999. Drove out here from... Well, I wasn't in New York at the whole time. I went down to Tampa, Florida, when things sort of dried up in New York. And everybody was just commiserating about being broke and poor and everything like that. I threw the nine things I owned into a rental car and just started driving.
But still doing comedy.
Yeah.
Once you started, did you ever stop? I mean, did you ever take pauses and go?
Well, the
only time
I paused was I got a writing job on a TV show.
What show was that?
The King of Queens.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's great.
I wrote there for the last 3 or 4 years of the show, and took time out.
Had you been going after writing for TV?
No.
Oh, that whole time? How'd that happen?
They wanted somebody on the show. They were looking to get somebody in there to punch things up a little bit, I guess. And they interviewed 2 or 3 comedians, I think. And they gave me the job, which was a good job. If you're going to have a job, you know, I'd rather not have a job. I'd rather be able to get by without a job. But
if you're going to have a job.
If you're going to have a job, it's a real good job. But I went from like having no bosses for 15 years to having 15 bosses in 1 year. But they were all nice people, and it was a nice experience. And they were all very, very smart comedically. So I learned a lot there that I would not have learned on my own, you know, just being at the table with these brilliant comedy writers. And I think I'm a better stand-up comedian for the time I spent there.
Hmm. Did you keep trying to work television, or were you just working gigs after that?
Right at the end of that was when the reality kicked in.
Yeah.
And things sort of dried up, and I didn't work too hard to get another gig. I kind of wanted to do stand-up. But I wouldn't mind getting another writing gig for a few more years.
Uh-huh.
You know, on the right sort of show, you know.
So you're traveling a lot now.
Yeah.
It's been very successful. You've done all the...
No.
Well, it has been, hasn't it?
What has been?
Your stand-up career.
Yeah.
No, why do you think it... Why do you think it hasn't?
Well, you know, I mean, success is measured in different ways. I mean, I don't have... I'm not making the money that I wish I was making. I'm not as popular as I wish I was. But... I'm still here. I'm still in it, and I'm still having fun. And
you having fun doing it?
Yeah, I'm still having fun doing the shows. I don't like the road so much. But you know, when you get a little bit older, it's not just as much fun. When you've been to a city 5 or 6 times, and you're a few years older than the people that are working at the club, it's just not. You know what I mean? I'm not partying. I'm not going out and.
Mm-hmm.
That's not as much fun. Only the shows are kind of fun. The rest of it is tedious, you know, getting on the planes and eating at Denny's in a strange place by yourself and getting up to go do radio at 7 a.m. It's sometimes when you get there, it's fun, but getting up to do it.
No, as I say, the shows are free.
Huh?
The shows are free. I get paid to do all the other stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
The waking up in the hotel and the flight and the getting frisked. By the TSA.
Right.
All right, that's free too.
Oh,
The shows and the getting frisked by the TSA agents, but the rest, yeah, is how
I
get paid.
Airline travel.
Here's my idea. Every seat on the plane becomes one of those pneumatic bank tubes, okay? The floor opens at the end. We are there. The fasten seatbelt sign goes up. Ding, and the chairs just straighten up and go, boom, and everyone just,
like
you know,
that.
Vanishes
like
down a pneumatic tube and ends up in baggage claim.
Where we wait.
Where we, of course, you wait for 30 minutes, but it's through a gift shop. So you have the opportunity to buy little trinkets. So just a couple more questions and I'll let you go. Because what is your – do you have an approach to writing? Do you have an approach when you sit down and think, I've got to come up with jokes? What do I do?
I don't sit down like I got to come up with jokes.
Do you write on the computer? Do you write with a pencil?
I do. I write with on the computer, but I have a lot of ideas all the time that I don't ever sit down to a blank piece of paper and go, I got to come up with jokes. I take notes throughout the world, throughout the days and the weeks, and then when I sit down, I look at that, and they're always kind of bouncing around in my head, what the bit might be. And sometimes when I sit down to kind of formalize it, to make it into something or find a place to squeeze it in or something that I can add to it. I don't sit down with a blank piece of paper with what I want. Now, that might do me good, but that's just never been my approach.
So you bring up onto the stage, you bring up a few just concepts. Sort of you bring up a couple of pieces of clay and then bring them up and try to shape something?
No, I kind of have a bit honed in my mind before I get it up on the stage. Mm-hmm. I don't kill myself with it, though. I have what I think would be the setup and the punchline. Usually it might be much longer than that, but I won't do too much of it at one time. But I don't go up there with vague notions and things like that. Sometimes I'll pop them out in the, when you're doing crowd work and stuff like that. You go, I know I got something about this, and you put a little pressure on yourself and something, you come up with something. Huh.
When you're out there on the road and Brian popped, I don't know, something happened. I don't even know, because I was making movies or something and Brian became one of the big guys that's doing concert halls or something.
Yeah,
I don't know what
he didn't pop.
He rose during that boom.
Yes, but no, he rose very, very gradually and still is rising gradually. But it was nothing that popped. It was just hard work and writing of comedy. And cultivating an audience, and it built over time. I don't know of anybody else that's done it like him without, or gotten to his level without some sort of a TV show, you know what I mean?
Right.
Or a part on a TV show.
Right.
And even people that had parts on TV shows aren't pulling in the audience that is out there that appreciates Brian, you know?
Yeah. No, I didn't mean it was some stroke of luck.
No, but I thought you thought maybe there was something that made, like, boom, that Brian is big now, which isn't
the it's probably a lot of Lettermans didn't hurt at that time.
Right.
For a wide audience.
Very, very incremental, though.
Well, of course, you're a great comedian, and I wanted to talk to you on the show, but also one of the reasons was I find you to be a nice guy, well-adjusted, having fun, doing shows, which flies in the face of the stereotype of comedians, which I hear about all the time, and you hear about, we're all psychotic malcontents who just sit in hotel rooms just hating everyone and hating life and with unsuccessful relationships everywhere in our lives. And just drinking to the wee hours of every morning. And I'm always like, well, I mean, I know a lot of guys who do it. And, I'm sure there are some of them like that. I don't hang out with those guys. Those guys who are pretty well adjusted and having a good time.
But it's not – do you think it's even a legitimate stereotype? But to me
– no, I think it's a romantic notion that writers have that they just kind of make up – in order to do some shorthand about show business.
Yeah, it's kind of a myth that the
this archetype of the dark, evil, hate-filled comedian.
I mean, it's been it's so much fun to be around these guys and these girls. Can I say girls? Women?
Sure.
Like when you have a poker game. Or say just say a poker game, and you're playing just eight other comedians, and every one of these guys or ladies was the funniest person in their high school,
right?
And they're not necessarily trying; they're not trying to be funny; they just are.
You're playing pickup basketball with Michael Jordan and Karl Malone or whatever.
Right,
you're playing with a very high level.
I mean, from the time I started doing it, I've just really enjoyed it. The stories that people have about other people and about club managers and other gigs that they've had—that's what what we laugh about. You know, other comics. When people wonder what we laugh about. We might sit in the audience of a great comedian and just kind of like go, okay, we won't be laughing that much. But when we talk about our own lives and the trials and tribulations of what we go through, you know.
Yeah. So what do you tell young comedians that meet you, that come out to see you, and want advice?
Well, it depends on if I just have a minute or if I have a few minutes to talk with them.
You have, 30 seconds and go.
No, well, and it depends on what their questions are. But I know one thing I tell them. Generally, if it's somebody who's never been on stage who is thinking, you know, they're writing and they got this and they're waiting and they think, one thing I tell them is that you will never be ready. You will never wake up one day and say, I'm ready to go on stage. Today's the day I feel it. You just have to do it. And then you've done it, whether you have success that night or not. And then you'll be ready to go back and do it again. And then you go a little bit at a time. And like we said before, how you do your first night really doesn't have any bearing on how you could do at it. You just have to start doing it. And
almost everybody's kind of not ready.
Nobody's ready.
I mean, it's a state of unreadiness because you don't know what's going to happen. It's the stage.
Right.
It's a lot of people in a room, and you're getting up in front under lights in front of people. So there's no sure thing.
Right.
We're just going up and winging this thing. Fortunately, you know, you got a pretty good batting average, so people pay you for it.
Right. And I remember one time I did a gig in Queens. Robert Klein was headlining, and I just met him. The green room was like behind this, behind the stage, and then I did my set, and I came back, and he said something nice about my set or whatever, and then he was standing there, and he said, "I hate this feeling. I hate this feeling." Because they were getting ready to introduce him, and I was like, "What? Really?" And he was like, "Yeah." Oh, he said, "Yeah." Before the show, he says, "I hate the feeling before the show. Once you get me up there, you can't get me off." But right before the show, and it kind of told me that's okay. That's why we do it, because it's interesting and exciting, and you never know. That's why we do it, you know. Now I don't always feel that way. Now I in fact I'm fairly comfortable in the right kind of situation, because I don't know, I've gotten comfortable with it, but there are, you know, situations where you're a little bit nervous, and
I've always said to people, you know, when you stop being nervous like that, something's wrong, or you should give up, or you should rethink it, because it is an unknown.
Are you saying there's something wrong with me now?
I'm saying, well, there's clearly something deeply wrong with you. That's, you know, that goes without saying. But I mean, when you don't feel that at all, because it is a room full of people who are going to be staring at you when you finally get to the microphone. I mean, they're staring at you.
Well, it is certainly. It's always there with a new bit, you know, a new piece. There's no confidence level in a new bit. You could be up there. You could just be crushing with a crowd, and you'll be thinking, do I want to do that new bit? And you'll go, I don't know. I'm really kind of crushing here, I think.
Yeah. So, but you're saying that you don't feel that Robert Klein thing. You feel when you're going up for a set, you feel like, all right, another one. Here we go.
For the most part, yeah. In comedy clubs, I'm not nervous anymore. You know, you at first you wonder if you're funny. You wonder if you belong in the business, and you wonder if you belong out there. You wonder if you belong on stage telling jokes. And then at a certain point, you know, the batting average is such that you go, I belong on stage. I should be. That's what I'm pretty good at it. Even if it doesn't go well tonight, it might not be fun, but it doesn't sting. It won't sting me like I'm going to be crushed with doubt about whether I should be doing this or not. You know?
Sure. Now, when Brian started to do magnificently well, and he's a great guy, could you be happy for your brother like that? Or was there a couple evenings in there where you think, boy, you know, a couple of rolls of the dice this way or that? You never know.
No, I am very happy for Brian. I'm very proud of Brian.
Because I don't know a soul on earth who doesn't say, hey, great guy, deserves every bit of it, magnificent comic, you know.
Exactly. And hard working, worked a lot harder than I have. I do.
You think it's just he just worked harder than you?
Well, I say just me, not just me. Yeah. He worked harder than everybody.
Yeah.
I don't know how hard everybody's worked, but if they just think it was just a matter of being funny, that's not it.
Right.
Brian has done a lot of things that most of us just don't do. He would go do radio and write down what bits he did on these radio shows and keep track of it and stuff like that. He approached it in a very business-like manner, and he worked real hard at writing material. And he's had albums and CDs. I've never even put out a CD. I like doing stand up. I like coming up with jokes and doing the shows, but this stuff about promoting and Twitter and YouTube and stuff like that, I'm just not behind the eight ball. And I don't know that I ever will be, you know?
Yeah. I might have said it on the podcast before, and I apologize if I did, but I remember when I was a kid and I was watching the tennis great Vitas Gerulaitis being interviewed. And the interviewer was kind of hinting, like, why don't you think your career – I mean, clearly you've done very well financially and everything, but why don't you think you've come to that level of a John McEnroe, of a Jimmy Connors? And he – right off the – he just – I don't want to work that hard. You know, I don't like tennis that much. Mm-hmm. And I'm a kid going, what? Because, I mean, I don't, you know, I like tennis. I mean, I'm good at tennis. I enjoy whatever. But if these guys play tennis like 10 hours a day. They practice until they're blisters on their hands, man. I just don't want to practice that much. And I just, I just don't like it that much. I have other things to do. So I just do it. And if that means I don't win Wimbledon or whatever and they win some, it's fine.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. There's a little bit of that in me. I mean, in a way, I'm a little embarrassed to not have worked harder or whatever. But I don't just think of myself, and you know, I don't think funny all the time. I there's other things I'm interested in, other things I like to do and to think about. It's a craft that I like. I like stand up and I like doing it, and I like getting better at it, but I just
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I don't want to take up too much of your time.
Ending on a downer.
Oh, sorry. Let's get into it. Hey, do the brothers and sisters, the firefighters and the various people, they enjoy having two guys in show business? Both comedians?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it's been interesting because Brian was at it a long time before I was. And I remember Brian saying one time, Brian appreciated when I came in because it kind of took a little bit of pressure off him at like family gathering, not of our family, but of, like other neighbors and friends and stuff like that, for that he was the comedian. And now I'm like, wait, right. There's another comedian.
So that you must have interesting stuff also, because generally like he would be the guy. Well, what's going on? Because we all have regular jobs. Right. So what are you? Now you have stories to tell.
Right. But, you know, it's another thing, too, is that I think people think sometimes, like I've just did Letterman again. And some people sort of on the outside of show business or whatever that are around our circle or family might think, well, Brian was doing comedy for a while and he got on Letterman. And then Dennis got into comedy, and he's done Letterman a few times and the Tonight Show. Like it's like that's just you get into comedy, and then a few years later,
anyone who thinks that, come on in and give it a shot.
Yeah,
come on in and try it.
Yeah, give it a try. But you know, the first time I did Letterman, this is what I tell, because a lot of times people ask me how did you get Letterman, and the first time I did it was I think 1999. And I did Ray Romano asked me to open for him at Carnegie Hall. And his show was new at the time, Everybody Loves Raymond. And I was happy to get that gig. And so I go there and I did 20 minutes and I really did about as well as I can do. You know, I really just kind of crushed Carnegie Hall. And it turned out that the Letterman people who produce the Ray's show were in the audience and up in the green room or whatever it is later. They said, we want you to do our show. And so not only did I, that night I crushed Carnegie Hall.
Pretty good night in New York City.
But I got Letterman. So when comedians ask me, say, how did you get Letterman? I go, well, this is how you do it. You get yourself a gig at Carnegie Hall, and you crush in front of the Letterman people.
Yeah.
So yeah. It seems sort of backwards, but that's how I did it.
Yeah. Do you have fun with that TV thing, doing the TV set?
Well, yes and no. That's a good question, because it's fun to be in the business. You know, it makes you feel like you're in the business, but I don't enjoy the process too much. I don't enjoy doing 4.5 minutes. I call it a festival of second guessing, because it's all you do is just for months you're this bit I don't want to do up front because they don't know me yet, and this is a little bit too mean, and I act this one out. I shouldn't be acting out and then I want to close with that, or I want to close another set, but that's a callback to this, and you just keep guessing and second guessing, and and it's a little bit nerve wracking. I mean, like I said, I'm not nervous in front of comedy clubs, because there's no. If the first joke doesn't work, you got a second joke. It doesn't matter. You'll be able to. I'll be able to pull it out. But if the first joke on Letterman doesn't work, it carries some importance. if you just go out,
and it's hard to do the rest of your set while you're heartbroken.
And it's easy to screw up a joke. Yeah. It's easy to screw up a joke. Depending on how specific you are with the wording, I'm fairly specific, but when I start to go over whatever my set is, I start thinking, I don't even know how to say this bit. I say it, but when I start to think about it, I go, I don't even know what I say.
What the wording is exactly.
Do I say it this way or do I say it? Mm-hmm, I don't even know what I say. And I start playing around with it too much or thinking, overthinking it, I guess. So as much fun as it is to be going on to Letterman, to have gone on to Letterman and those shows, it's more fun to go up in front of 100 people on a Thursday night at some spot,
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks so much, Dennis. I appreciate you coming to Wilson World and talking to me.
Oh, it was fun. Thanks for having me.
Man.
I appreciate listening to this podcast.
Thanks so much to Dennis Regan for giving me some of his time. Check him out at Dennis Regan, R-E-G-A-N, .com. It was great to talk to him. Thanks so much for downloading this podcast. Thanks for your feedback. You can contact me at info@TomWilsonUSA.com. Check me out on the web at TomWilsonUSA.com or BigPopFun.com. Hey, thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris, Katie, everybody over at Nerdist for their support. Thanks to McPherson Guitars, Dean Markley Strings for all helping me out on the road. Come on out and see a show. Say hi afterwards, would you? Tell me that you listen to the podcast. It means a lot to me. It really does. I appreciate all the feedback I'm getting, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.